Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Our farm is more resilient against flood and drought. We are more resilient to supply disruptions, and we have a systematic approach that will be economically profitable and viable for generations to come. We need to help American farmers integrate cover crops into their operation within their context. We need to also help American ranchers adopt regenerative grazing practices. On behalf of Regenerate America Coalition, we are pushing to ensure the next farm bill robustly supports regenerative ag.
Rick Clark is owner of Clark Land and Cattle Company in Indiana.
We need better education and technical assistance, equitable opportunities and access, infrastructure and processing, healthy and regionally sourced food, farmland preservation, incentives for soil health and risk mitigation.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We have obviously made a commitment in this administration to expanding access to high-speed internet.
It's Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack talking about the importance of rural broadband.
The opportunity for families, businesses, schools, healthcare facilities to have the latest and best technology to be able to access the distance learning, the telemedicine, the business opportunities, and the needs of families with this very important 21st century technology. Many parts of the country today still have limited internet access in terms of upload and download speeds that simply don't allow for multiple uses in a home, don't accommodate distance learning or telemedicine, and don't allow businesses to expand market opportunities, and would not allow farmers the opportunity at precision agriculture. And for that reason, the USDA, receiving resources from Congress, has established the ReConnect program, in which we are working with providers to increase the upload and download speeds and the capacity of these networks to essentially handle what is called 100 megabits per second upload and download speeds.
And has announced more money being invested.
With the announcement today, we're adding an additional $502 million of investment in 20 states. These resources are divided between loans and grants, with roughly $141 million in loans and $360 million or so in grants. This is the second announcement that has been made in the Biden-Harris administration. Up to this point, in round three, we have announced $858 million of additional investments. We anticipate and expect additional announcements in the very near future to add to that total. Just as a reminder, we initially had $1.15 billion available under round three of the ReConnect program. We expect and anticipate to announce the balance of that program very soon, and may very well also announce portions of the bipartisan infrastructure law funding, where the USDA received a little over $1.9 billion of additional resources for ReConnect.
So what's a specific example of how this will work?
Take, for instance, a Colorado project. The Delta Montrose Electric Association is receiving nearly a $14 million grant to expand access to almost 3,600 folks, 148 businesses, 765 farms, and a school. In addition to increasing access to high-speed internet, this association will also make available to its members the Affordable Connectivity Program that FCC has established, and the Lifeline program, which means that individuals in the service area will have access potentially at no cost or low cost to these internet services. Or the project in the TCC of Jackson, Inc. in Mississippi, a $22 million grant impacting and affecting nearly 10,000 people in that area, 92 businesses and 310 farms, a fiber-to-premises network being established and upgraded. Really valuable investments, particularly in Newton and Lawrence counties and Simpson County, an opportunity to increase access to struggling families financially. Again, the FCC Affordable Connectivity Program and Lifeline being made available.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, week over week, I don't like to put too much emphasis on it. You are heading into a time of year where typically you start to see more feeder cattle enter the market.
Caitlin McCulloch is director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
Although there has been a lot of drought movement, and so that might be a volume type of proposition, depending on what's going on state by state. But generally speaking, this is the time of year where we would expect feeder cattle values to soften. You've also had a pretty dramatic change in the feed cost from where we were been. So you recall at the beginning of the year, a huge rally in corn costs, but then we thought we might have a better corn crop and they fell over a dollar in most places. Those have started to come back up as USDA has lowered yield and took about 1 million acres out of planted for corn. So feeder cattle prices are being influenced by higher feed costs and generally a higher feed outlook than maybe they were even just a month ago.
She talks about the strength of the dollar.
I think the exchange rate always plays a role, and in the U.S. dollar being stronger doesn't necessarily help, especially when our beef prices are already very high and scheduled to get higher if we look at the outlay. It's been interesting to watch. I think we do have this sense of global uncertainty, recession, rising interest rates across the world. All those things are playing into this, and U.S. beef isn't getting any cheaper. And so it might have something to do with what's happening in each of these countries' economies. Beef is a relatively higher priced option. We have seen a little bit more interest in pork as of late. So if you think about pork exports, we had pretty big declines every month, almost the entire year. And that gap's narrowed substantially. So we're looking at quantities more similar to a year ago, down about only 5%, I believe, in the last month. And so we're looking at fall seasonal buying from China might take an uptick. I would expect pork to move a little bit better this fall in terms of where it's been relative to earlier in the year. And on beef, I'm really watching that price and to see what happens. Again, we've been pretty reliant on China being the taker of U.S. beef, which has been great for the industry. But if you see any slowdown there, that's what we're going to watch out for.
And the ongoing inflation concerns.
Unfortunately, I'm a pessimist, so I'm not expecting it to get substantially better. It looks like the Fed's going to raise interest rates and try and combat it. Now, the thing to keep in mind is if the CPI does not go any higher, as in just stays flat the rest of the year, you'd still be looking at a 6%+ interest rate in December. So that's a pretty powerful number to say, hey, even if things don't go up, it's still going to be very high inflation relative to historical standards. I probably don't think we're going to be able to stay even. We'll probably go up slightly, but the rate of change has slowed down. And I think that's important to recognize. I had someone tell me just last week that they saw $8 a pound butter. And I know we don't talk about dairy necessarily on this podcast, but if you think about what a consumer might do, I mean, I would do a lot less baking if I had to pay $8 a pound for butter. And so those types of conversations or even mental awareness is going to continue to wear on the consumer. And two, the length at which they've been dealing with these increased prices, they might just start to be making different choices. Those savings rates have come down. Things might look a little different than they did last year when we first started to see that high inflation number.
But will we see demand destruction?
And this is the number one question we have for beef and beef demand is, do you see some changing of volume of beef that U.S. consumers are consuming? It's difficult to say. I mean, demand has been a lot stronger than we anticipated given where prices have been in the last 12 months. And does that start to erode beef demand at some point?
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There's a great deal that's going on, especially in that produce arena.
That's Andy Levine. He is president and CEO, American Seed Trade Association.
Unfortunately, over the years, because of the regulatory structure on the domestic level and the international level, biotechnology has not gone down to the level of fruits and vegetables across the board, whether it's tree fruit or planted crops that are planted by seed. And because of that, it's been focused mainly on breeding, and we've been able to do a lot with breeding. But as we look at policy toward newer methods like gene editing, we want to make sure that there's that opportunity within the produce arena to take advantage of these breeding methods as they continue to evolve and improve. And we're seeing research in blackberries and raspberries and in
things like mustard plants and other crops, tomatoes, that are going to be beneficial from a nutritional standpoint. They're going to be beneficial from a food waste standpoint, as well as from a grower standpoint. So we think everyone will benefit. One of the things that is important here, though, Tony, as I mentioned, is the policy has to be right. If it limits the ability for the industry to use these, it will be restricted a lot, like biotech is, to 3 or 4 crops.
Also talks about a recent White House executive order on biotechnology.
I think it's good when the administration looks to focus on the opportunities in the bioeconomy and the bio arena, whether it's biotechnology or biomanufacture. It's really good for the seed industry. I mean, we're a sector of agriculture and food that's based on innovation and constant innovation. And a lot of that comes from the biological or biotechnology arena. And it's important that the government stresses from the very top, from the White House, that the government stresses that the agencies and departments have to work together. So EPA, FDA, USDA need to collaborate in their policy and regulatory development, or you end up with a patchwork that hinders innovation instead of enhances it.
And he also talks about treated seed.
EPA is looking at a petition or a lawsuit that was filed by a non-governmental organization a little while ago to make a decision to take treated seed out of what's called the treated article exemption that's within the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. It's a mouthful, but we call it FIFRA. And that governs the registration and use of pesticides throughout the United States. And it's really a misnomer. It's not an exemption, or isn't a treated article exemption. What it basically says is the act of applying the pesticide on the product, in this case seed, is governed by EPA and controlled by EPA. So the pesticide has to be registered by EPA and approved, and it has to be used when it's applied on the seed in the way that it's stated on the label of the pesticide. And that's where, after that, it's then considered a treated article, and that treated article is used however it is intended to be used. In this case, it's planted as a seed, and it's, you know, it doesn't have to be regulated as a pesticide application, because the application has already been made to the seed to protect it. So we're concerned that states are going to try to pull that out of the treated article exemption under FIFRA and regulate it, so that essentially it would say every time a farmer planted a treated seed, it would be considered a application, and the farmer would have to, you know, have all the proper, whether it's approvals and certifications to make that pesticide application.
This is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The application process for round 4 under the bipartisan infrastructure law is still open and will remain so until November 2nd.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack announcing more money to cover rural broadband.
State and local governments, corporations, Native American tribes, cooperative associations can make application for the grant and loan monies available under round 4.
Some might wonder, with all this money in the federal government, how does the left hand know what the right is doing?
The assumption of your question is that we're not working hand in fist. And honestly, I was surprised that folks were saying that, because that has not been the case, at least as long as I've been in this job here at USDA. There are ongoing regular meetings between USDA, FCC, and the Department of Commerce to coordinate our efforts, and coordination has been good. I think right now what we're attempting to do, we meaning the executive branch, we're attempting to make sure we have a good, accurate read on where the gaps are in terms of coverage. And the beauty of this process is that USDA has a very specific role, and that role is to essentially within the infrastructure law and within the round 3 funding, that goal is to essentially increase the capacity of existing facilities and existing networks. The FCC effort and Commerce's effort is really designed for a slightly different mission, which is to address the areas of the country where there is no, where there's unserved populations. So I think there's been a good separation and distinction between the missions of this of these funding streams. And there has been, as I say, ongoing regular meetings between the three the two departments and the FCC. So I think we are working collaboratively and we're working closely. And in fact, just to give you another data point, before we can make these announcements of the projects we're funding, we actually have to work with the FCC to make sure that we're not creating a circumstance where there is a duplication of effort. And we've been very conscientious about making sure that there's not a duplication of effort and that we're not providing resources unnecessarily to an area that already either has coverage or is accessing other resources. So the collaboration has been better than I guess perhaps we need to do a better job of communicating the fact that we are communicating with each other.
It is worth noting there is one major condition of the grant.
I think most significantly is that a condition of this grant is that entities participate in FCC's affordable connectivity program. In other words, the provider of this service has to put together a package of services available to folks that cost $30 or less a month, so that the affordable connectivity program, which provides a subsidy of $30 a month, will cover the cost of the service. It may very well be that the criteria by which the FCC determines your participation in that is tied to your income and a percentage of the poverty level, but we'll get that information to you.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We specialize in repair of all smartphones and tablets, as well as Apple-branded computers. We also provide data recovery and micro-soldering services.
Brian Clark, co-owner of the iGuys Tech Shop, testifying recently before a House Small Business Committee.
We founded the business in 2012. We recognized the Conway area desperately needed local options for repair of devices that were becoming increasingly important to everyday life. Conway lies in a very rural part of the state in the heart of the White Mountains, a very popular tourist destination. The permanent population of the area that we serve is somewhere around 100,000 people based on 2020 census data, but this is covering a very large area at over 1,000 square miles. We serve around 1,200 to 1,500 paying customers every year on average. As an independent shop, we have no affiliation with any manufacturer. Even as the industry has evolved over the last decade, we still find that it is best for our business and, more importantly, our customers to remain independent. Any paths to becoming an authorized repair facility are far from ideal and generally incredibly invasive to our business and restrictive in what we can do for our customers. Of course, there are drawbacks to this choice, as most manufacturers continue to offer independent shops little to no official access to genuine parts, repair manuals, tools, or schematics. Manufacturers want control over how and whether your device gets repaired by forcing customers to authorized repair. For Apple devices, the nearest authorized repair facility, in this case an Apple Authorized Service Provider, or AASP, is about 45 minutes from my shop. The nearest Apple store, 1 hour and 15 minutes away. For Samsung and Google devices, the closest facility about 1 hour and 30 minutes away. If you have a device from another manufacturer, such as Motorola or LG, mail-in repair is your only option. Because New Hampshire becomes increasingly rural as you go north, all of these authorized repair options are located in the more densely populated southern parts of the state. This means that most of our customers would need to drive an additional 45 to 90 minutes after already frequently driving up to an hour or more just to reach us. This situation is far from unique to northern New Hampshire. I do want to be clear on that. There are countless locations around the country where similar or worse situations can be encountered. Over the decade that we've been in business, we've seen countless scenarios repeat and replay themselves over and over again for our customers. In my written testimony, I play out four examples of real-world scenarios that are incredibly common for a rural repair shop like mine. With the limited time I have here today, I'd like to highlight the common threads that come into play in these scenarios that we see so frequently. First of all, the devices that we service have become tools, tools that are integral to their people's day-to-day lives at home, at work, and in businesses. Access to timely repair for folks that find themselves without these tools is crucial, and in rural areas, that would be nearly impossible without independent repair. Time and time again, we are able to get folks back up and running with far less interruption to their lives than if they were forced to use solely authorized repair options. Misleading information. When contacting authorized repair, consumers are not always given completely truthful information. More specifically, they are told that certain things cannot be repaired, when they really mean that the manufacturer does not offer an authorized repair option for the customer's problem. This practice is very unfriendly to the consumer and is part of an effort to force replacement of devices, something that is not always easy to do in rural areas. Keeping technology in use is important. Not everyone cares to have the latest and greatest tech. Not everyone can afford to the latest and greatest tech, as Gordon Byrne alluded to. We found this especially true in rural areas like ours. Independent repair gives folks in these situations the option to keep their device going, even if the manufacturer no longer wishes to provide official repair. And the last thing is data. The information we keep on these devices is often priceless. A business owner frequently has contacts and communication on their device that would be irreplaceable if lost. Almost all of us keep photographs and other personal data on our devices that would be devastating to lose. Authorized repair generally provides no options for a situation where data recovery is needed. Their point of view is that if you didn't back it up, it's your fault.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm excited for today's hearing, emphasizing stakeholder perspectives on farm bill conservation programs.
Abigail Spanberger, representative from Virginia and the chairwoman of a House Ag Subcommittee on Conservation.
American farmers and producers have a long history of being among the best stewards of our land and promoting conservation practices as a way of protecting our environment for generations to come. Ensuring that they have the tools they need to best take care of the land for today and for future generations is critical to the policy decisions that we make in this committee. And I hope that we can use today's conversation as an opportunity to listen and learn from our producers and growers about what they need as we head into drafting the 2023 Farm Bill. As part of today's hearing, we will hear how our conservation programs are currently working for producers, how investments in conservation programs are addressing our resource needs, and how these programs can be utilized to help address the climate crisis. I am pleased that we are hearing from producers, conservation professionals, and advocates who understand today's evolving challenges, from water scarcity to increased input costs in raising everything from cattle to wheat. I appreciate that today's witnesses have taken the time away from their important work to discuss the current state of Farm Bill conservation programs so that we can make informed policy decisions that will make the programs easier for producers to use to address their resource concerns while also providing environmental, social, climate, and overall economic benefits.
Now, the ranking member of that conservation subcommittee is a farmer himself from Northern California, Doug LaMalfa.
I'm glad we got a chance one more time to discuss the 2018 Farm Bill conservation title. The Title II programs are voluntary and incentive-based, providing direct benefits to producers, their operations, and the land itself. The delivery of the Farm Bill's conservation programs is a proven model that we know works and will continue to be important for the long-term success of our farmers, ranchers, growers, and the rural areas nationwide. Since the 1985 Farm Bill, conservation programs have continued to evolve to better support American agriculture with some of the most significant reforms in just the past two reauthorizations. This includes program consolidation and streamlining, which have improved the delivery of conservation programs by making them simpler and easier for the producers to navigate. The committee has worked hard to keep these programs producer first while protecting mandatory funding for essential programs. As this committee begins crafting the next conservation title, I'm hopeful we can build on these reforms and maintain the emphasis and support for working lands, programs, and farm infrastructure. Since the beginning of this Congress, there has been a lot of attention placed on environmental regulations, soil health, and ways that farm conservation programs can help sequester more carbon. Through a variety of recent actions, significant new funding for so-called climate smart activities, and several main Farm Bill conservation programs that hasn't been made available or will be soon. Specifically, this includes a $3.5 billion Climate Smart Practices Pilot Program USDA is currently administering. This funding is being released unilaterally and comes with no mandate, direction, or authorization from Congress on how to actually distribute it. In addition, this new funding comes on top of the most recent reconciliation package passed last month, which provided roughly $20 billion for four conservation programs. So since it's not clear how this new funding will be obligated or specifically utilized by the department, this committee must conduct oversight as USDA administers an enormous amount of taxpayer dollars, especially with a new farm bill on the horizon. In light of this, the House Ag Committee must be mindful of this massive amount of funding before amending programs and making policy changes that reorient conservation programs more towards climate mitigation.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Last month, USDA basically took a bit over 1 million bales off its cotton production forecast because of expected declines in yields and harvested acreage. This week, USDA took a new look at yields and at acreage information and basically added a bit over 1 million bales back into its production forecast.
The big increase in production is coming from 750,000 acre increase in harvested area.
USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski says the crop now is expected to be 13.8 million bales, 21% smaller than last year instead of 25%. And so,
year over year, supplies are still down. Stocks are tightening up year over year, and that's continuing to support prices.
USDA did take a penny off of its projected season average price, which is 96 cents a pound, still 4 cents higher than this last season. Gary Crawford, Washington.